Welcome to the Devils in the Details radio show, broadcasting live from Skid Row Studios in lovely downtown Los Angeles. My name is Wyme Russell, and I'll be hosting this show each week with my very talented co-host. He is an artist, a photographer, a stand-up comedian. I welcome my partner to our inaugural broadcast, Mr. Nestor Rodriguez.
Yay, yay. What's popping?
How's it going, man?
All right.
Glad you're here with me, Nestor, here to share the next hour of truth and investigations into the conspiratorial world of conspiracy theories.
Looking forward to it.
You can call into the show at 800-893-9562 or watch live by going to Ustream and searching for Skid Row Studios. That's 800-893-9562. We'd love to talk to you and share your thoughts and opinions and the information that we provide in this program. On the Devils with the Details show, we will be discussing topics, as I just mentioned, that mainstream society considers to be conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
Nestor, tell me how you feel when somebody calls you a conspiracy theorist.
I've actually never been called a conspiracy theorist, just like an overly opinionated person.
Lucky you.
And a cynic. I'm a cynic and a pessimist. So, I often find it amusing when you posed questions about certain things and you don't believe that certain things are the way they are. And I find it amusing how easy and how readily accepting certain people are,
right,
of so-called facts or so-called presentations.
Well, what we're hoping to find and the audience that we're looking for on this show, and I hopefully that everybody's listening is going to have and come to the show with a very open mind. Because the information that we're going to present to you, although may not be completely foreign to you, is going to strike a nerve or going to pull at your, it's going to demand a lot of patience.
But hopefully we'll make you ask questions and try to investigate
that is the whole
such
point.
Questions on your own.
That is correct. We're going to try to wake up some people out there. So let's just go ahead and get started. So, Nestor, you mentioned you were, I understand you are from New York.
I'm from New York.
And you were in New York on the morning of 9/11.
Sure was.
Just give us a quick idea of what that must have been like to be. I was here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But what was that like?
I want to hear how it was like for you too, by the way.
I'll be glad to tell
you.
Well,
for me, it was bizarre. I mean, I was working in Midtown. I was working in construction at the time as an electrician. And I was working at the Toys R Us store in Midtown. And we were working from like 7 p.m. To 3 a.m., some weird hour.
Now, how close was that to the
actual? Midtown is like 46th Street.
Okay.
So, and the World Trade Center side is a few miles south.
Okay.
But, you know, the thing is that I was asleep. And, you know, it happened around 9 o'clock or so, right? What was it, the exact time? 9:20 or something like that. So my wife wakes me up. I'm sleeping and she shakes me and she goes, "Oh my God, look at this." So I'm half in a daze. That wasn't my normal time to get up.
Right.
So I was half in a daze and also kind of speechless. I mean, I'm looking at these images, you know, the images that everyone has known to associate with the 9/11 event, the events of 9/11, the planes crashing repeatedly. And I was like, you know, what the fuck? Like, at that point, you don't know what to make of it. I guess the same way as you see the people in the video, people who are actually downtown working, and they're all fucking confused. They don't know what the hell's going on. So it was just bizarre. I mean, you don't know what to make of it.
Very interesting, man.
Yeah. How was it for you in L.A.?
I came into it halfway through the process. I mean, the first tower had already collapsed. My wife had mentioned to me that I better come take a look at what's happening on television.
But this is 6 a.m. for you guys, 6:20, right?
It was very early. I remember the sun was up already, so it wasn't like the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting about it was that I immediately started, of course, you called in sick and took the day off. I mean, it really struck me, you know, in a very personal place.
Mm.
But I started popping in videotapes just all day long, just running the videotapes. And it's helped a lot in the investigation processes or looking back at the independent investigations And having a lot of that firsthand news footage to actually corroborate a lot of the information.
You mentioned videotapes. You started popping in videotapes and just watching all day?
Just recording the news, just as it all occurred.
Oh, got it. Wow. And you did that because it just prompted you to, like, hold on to it, to reference it later on?
It was just an important thing. This was an incredible event.
Wow.
So Nestor, you know what? Let's stay on track. Let's try to, you know, this is our first show. So let's start it in the very beginning. So if this is a show on conspiracy theory, let's lay the groundwork on what a conspiracy theory actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go through a brief definition or wordplay. And as we were already discussing 9/11, so you can imagine that our first topic on our first show will be the events of September 11th.
And we'll probably revisit this throughout series. Yeah.
We'll have to have multiple shows on 9/11, but we won't bombard you with it too much. But we do want the truth to be set free.
Right.
So let's visit a definition of conspiracy theory from a gentleman who made a movie about the events of September 11th in 2004. His name is David Von Kleist, and he made a very good documentary entitled In Plain Sight. Now, that's In Plain, S-I-T-E. And if you haven't seen the film, I would recommend you take a look at it.
Plain as an airplane.
Correct. Right. And so... what's important in this documentary is that in the very beginning, he gives a very simple definition of what a conspiracy theory actually is. And it's kind of a wordplay. So I have a clip of that. I'd like to go to Mr. Von Kleist. Let's listen to what he has to say, and then I want to get your thoughts, Nestor.
Well, in the phrase conspiracy theory, there are two words. The first word, conspiracy. The second word is the active word, theory. By definition, a theory is a supposition, an idea, a concept, a hypothesis. Let me give you an example. In theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I could win a prize. Now, as long as I don't purchase a raffle ticket, my win is theoretical. But once you purchase a raffle ticket, the win is no longer a theory. It becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets you purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. Such is the case with a conspiracy theory.
So if you look at it in the most simple terms of what he's describing, and again, that was a clip from Mr. David Von Kleist from 9/11 In Plain Sight. If you break that down in its most simplest terms, if you apply that to that thought process to something like 9/11, and you have one question or one shred of evidence that the 9/11 Commission Report didn't address, then we have that proverbial raffle ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And we are no longer dealing with a conspiracy theory, but with the events of 9/11 particularly, we are dealing with a conspiracy. So in the opening of the show, when I asked you how you felt to be called a conspiracy theorist, that's what we are all called.
Right.
Because we simply questioned the official story.
Right.
How do you feel about the definition? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, definitely.
Raffle tickets and
definitely. I mean, what I get out of it is that, if you have a question about something, then you have to accept that there's a possibility of something else other than what you're presented, right? I mean, you and I have discussed anything could be argued, ad infinitum. I mean, unless you actually prove something, in your own, if you and I both see something and witnesses and we both agree upon it at the same time, then you and I can say, yes, that's what happened.
Right.
But if someone's not there, what do they go by? You know, the information that they've been given.
Correct. All right. Well, what we're going to do today on the events of 9/11, we briefly touched on what we did that morning. I was just with my wife and we got the bad news, watched on television, popped tapes in and out, took the day off. Mm. And I always had these tapes to kind of go back. And once the 9/11 investigations hit, I kind of had something to rewind and see, could they possibly be telling the truth? And
wow.
And it was crazy. The information that was coming out from the news that day, multiple explosions,
the conflicting information.
Yeah. And we only heard that the first day. So when a lot of these movies came out and the investigations came out, I was able to go back and find that information.
Right.
So it was very interesting, but it's a horrible event. And we absolutely mean no disrespect to the victims or the victims' families, amongst any of the opinions we share. We are certainly in your corner. We just want to find the truth of why your loved ones were murdered on that day.
Right.
So let's jump to what we're going to call the five smoking guns of 9/11. Okay, so that's what basically the show is going to be about today. We're going to go through five points that I consider, or that the mainstream 9/11 truth movement considers to be the smoking gun. So these aren't new. This isn't new information. We're not breaking any ground today. But we do want to start in the beginning, and we want to lay down the foundation correctly. So what we're going to do is go ahead and jump in. Let's just jump to number one, and that is the Norman Mineta's testimony to the 9/11 Commission. Are you familiar with Mr. Norman Mineta? He was our transportation secretary under George W. Bush.
And you know what? I'm not familiar with.
Well, I'm about to get you familiar with him.
Get me familiar.
All right. And this is this was a gentleman who was in charge. He was tasked with bringing down all of the planes on the morning of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So he successfully brought down 4,546 airplanes.
Right.
Cleared the entire U.S. airspace without incident. So this was a good guy, and he was just doing his job. Mm-hmm. So this was kind of a good guy caught in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just play his clip. And what I want you to do, Nestor, is think about possibly what he could be talking about. Now, he's referring to the flight that allegedly flew into the Pentagon, Flight 77. So let's listen to Mr. Norman Mineta, the Transportation Secretary under George Bush, testifying before the 9/11 Commission.
I wanted to focus just a moment on the Presidential Emergency Operating Center. You were there for a good part of the day. I think you were there with the vice president. And we had that order given, I think it was by the president, that authorized the shooting down of commercial aircraft that were suspected to be controlled by terrorists. Were you there when that order was given?
No, I was not. I was made aware of it during the time that the airplane coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?
So what is he telling to the 9/11 Commission there, Nestor? So he's mentioning that he's in the bunker, the emergency bunker that morning, okay? And that is the bunker under the White House. And that is where Mr. Cheney and all of our top officials were taken. They were actually moved to that position.
To be protected.
And to be protected and to continue to operate our government,
mm-hmm.
To bring the planes down, mm-hmm, to operate our mm-hmm. defenses.
A safe operations headquarters.
Correct. And now Mr. Mineta arrived in the bunker after Dick Cheney, which perjures Cheney's testimony because Cheney testifies that he was actually in the bunker at a later time. But that's another point. But what we're going to do, give me an example of how you feel about Lee Hamilton, who was asking him the question. He mentioned a possible shoot down order for the plane that was heading towards Flight 77. That's what we just heard.
Right.
He asked him, were you aware that there was a shoot down order? And his answer was, a gentleman kept coming into the room to Dick Cheney, asking him, 50 miles out, 40 miles out, 30 miles out. And does the order still stand?
Mm-hmm.
What order are we talking about? This is mm-hmm. a smoking gun in the 9/11 investigations.
Right. The order to shoot down any planes that are still in the air after they get all the planes down.
That is the elaborate hoax that they are trying to create mm-hmm. with that clip and that discussion. Mm-hmm. The question was directly pointed at, okay, so you understood there was a shoot down order, then what happened? But something hit the Pentagon.
Right.
From 50 miles out,
right.
40 miles out, 30 miles out, and something allegedly impacted, and it did, something did impact.
Something.
So was that a shoot down order or a stand down order?
Right.
Not to shoot and to let the target,
right.
Or to let the plane or missile hit the target.
Right.
So what are we talking about? Is it a stand down or is it a shoot down?
After all the planes were ordered to come down, you're saying? The Pentagon.
This is when the Flight 77 was still in the air. Mm-hmm. So we were still in the middle of the planes had already crashed into the towers of the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. Flight 77 was coming into the Pentagon, mm-hmm. and a gentleman kept coming into to Cheney and saying, "It's 50 miles out, 40 miles out, 30 miles out. Do the orders still stand?"
Right.
And Cheney got angry and says, "Of course the orders still stand. What orders are we talking about?
Right.
We've never been privileged to what those orders were."
Right.
And obviously, nothing was shot down over Washington that day.
Right.
Something hit its target.
Right.
So Cheney obviously had orders to allow the missile or plane to hit.
Mm-hmm.
One quick point. Dick Cheney had usurped NORAD's control to disrupt or shoot down an aircraft in the summer leading up to September 11th.
NORAD being?
The North American Aerospace Defense Command. That's what's in the mountain in Cheyenne. What they do is they control our airspace. So
if
a plane goes up and it's missing, they'll scramble some planes and they'll go up and they'll find it.
Right.
If something's amiss, they have the right to shoot it down.
Right.
They don't need orders from the president.
Right.
In the summer leading up to September 11th, Dick Cheney usurped that control, took it back, put it under the president, and gave it back the day after 9/11.
Mm.
I tell you, I ask you, Nestor, what are your thoughts?
I mean, you know, that whole clip and all that stuff is very complex. I have actually seen video clips of the damage that was done to the Pentagon, and there's no debris. I mean, there's no debris of a plane,
right?
And on the grounds,
where's the only thing only
of
that
the
you,
Pentagon,
only
just
that you
a
could
hole
hold in your and only but pieces the big enough that you could hold in your hand.
It's bizarre. It's
ridiculous.
It's fucking bizarre.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a news clip where they report there's a crater that's in front of the Pentagon.
Of the Pentagon?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, and there is no crater.
There is no
there's
crater.
Nothing. There's
no.
There's nothing but grass, ground, some fire trucks
untouched ground where a scraping would have had to occur.
Of course, if a plane actually crashed into the Pentagon,
right,
there would have been
something.
Outside evidence, some
wings.
Scraping to the earth, to the ground right outside of Pentagon. There would have been some
wings, tails.
There would have been
fuselage.
Some wing damage to the something. I mean,
something.
You're thinking that the head of the plane went into the Pentagon,
right.
And I don't know. It's bizarre.
It was a stand down order on that morning to allow whatever went into
whatever
that building,
whatever object
to
that
hit
was
it,
in the sky to hit it,
and it came from the highest office in our government.
Right.
All right, let's move to number two. This is number two smoking gun of 9/11. Let's listen to, I'll just play the clip on this one and we'll go ahead and talk about it. This is Mayor Rudolph Giuliani on the morning of September 11th as he is interviewed about he was moving through the streets that morning, obviously through all the terror, and he was looking for his place to set up an emergency station,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, where they can all meet and discuss. And found out some interesting pre-collapse information, and he actually, admitted that in an interview. Let's listen.
Number. I saw people jumping out of the World Trade Center. I saw some of the firefighters who I know going into the building. So, and we were in a building in which we were trapped for about 10, 15 minutes.
Are you talking about the, did you go immediately to the Office of Emergency Management?
I went down to the scene and we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could actually get out of the building. So we were trapped in the building for 10, 15 minutes and finally found an exit and got out, walked north, and took a lot of people.
So why weren't the firefighters called away from the buildings? Why weren't the police officers called out of the buildings?
Well, forget all that, right?
Mm.
We were told they were going to collapse. Really?
Really?
I mean, everyone was fucking amazed when they collapsed. They weren't expecting that to happen.
Right.
I mean, the buildings came down. I mean, there's other reports, people, eyewitnesses, documentation, investigation on the fact that it appeared to be a controlled demolition.
That's right.
That the buildings flopped down. It was controlled. Dude, right. If those things would have collapsed normally, you've seen the aerial photographs of the World Trade Center site. Nothing is damaged. I mean, there's buildings.
They fell in their own footprint.
The World Financial Center is across near the Hudson River. It's all glass. It's a glass dome. Yeah. Just particles broke through the glass atrium. It's just, I mean, that's bizarre. That's bizarre. We were told to get out because the buildings were going to collapse.
Can you imagine?
Now,
who did he have surrounding him that day? And this is another quick point to 9/11. And you wonder, when you mention this information to somebody, they commonly say, Now, there's no way our government could ever do anything like that. But when you look at who Giuliani had surrounding him at the time of 9/11, Bernard Carrick was the head of the New York City Police Department. Mm-hmm. Now, you would only have somebody like Bernard Carrick in charge of your police station if you were going to run an operation like 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you, I recommend you to Google Bernard Carrick.
Yes, Google him.
He K-E-R-I-K. Was,
and very interesting guy.
Very interesting, and he's a big-time criminal, and he rose through the ranks of the NYPD.
Well, he was supposed to be mayor, right? He was running for mayor, and then he got...
Heaven help us.
No, but I'm saying, I believe there's a few books out on him, and I believe... that some shit came out on him that he had to like walk away with his tails between his leg, you know, which I was shocked because, I mean, he was made out to be a hero and he was a hero up until whatever came out about him.
I believe he's in prison.
Is he really?
I believe he's in prison.
And what were the charges?
Your guess is as good as mine Mr. Carrick.
Yeah.
Take your pick.
I'm going to look it up.
I believe he was taking some sort of
bribes.
I believe it.
Yeah, right. But there were other things that he was.
So why is somebody like Mayor Rudolph Giuliani privileged to pre-collapse information?
Right.
How would they have come up with pre-collapse information if these were accidental pancake collapses that nobody imagined was coming?
Right.
What do you think, man?
Right. I'm dumbfounded by that. I mean, that's crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
And that is incriminating, and it is ignored by everybody, the major
media. It's crazy.
So let's move on then. Let's just go to number three, and this is one of my favorites because this person is, if there is a hierarchy of people who are responsible for September 11th, in my opinion, it moves in this order. We would go from Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, to the next gentleman, Mr. Larry Silverstein. And if those three ever spilled their guts, or one of those three, the world would be a different place the following day or immediately. So let's just jump into what Mr. Larry Silverstein and who this gentleman is. So this is the leaseholder or the real estate mogul developer who actually controls the World Trade Center site. He
owns the rights to the site.
He leases it. He's the leaseholder. So he actually built Building 7, but then went in for he wanted to bid to control the entire complex. And in July of 2001, so just a few months before September 11th, he actually won the bid to control the entire, facility. So he actually was the leaseholder on all of the buildings when they actually were attacked. So Mr. Silverstein is very interesting, and I just want to play this clip, and this is regarding Building 7. Now, Building 7 was the third building to collapse, which wasn't hit by an airplane, which itself is a smoking gun within the 9/11 community. Now, why did Building 7 fall? Nestor, what are your thoughts on Building 7? Why would that fall 5 hours later in the afternoon into its own, with a perfect crimp, free fall speed, meaning that there's no area of resistance within the building. It's coming down as if you would drop a feather off the top into its own footprint.
Right. I have no idea. I mean, and the whole thing is bizarre. I actually have a photo of that building just kind of like, it looks like a melted, flop. It's just, I don't know, it's weird. It's weird. It doesn't make any sense.
And when you say melting, there was a lot of melting going on in all of the rubble. A lot of the pictures you see, there was a lot of melting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my own ideas or theories is that the explosive used was a high military grade type explosive. Now, this was by the Architects of Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I recommend you visit that site as well. Mm-hmm. They have come up with this hypothesis that there was a military-grade explosive called thermite or thermate that was actually an incendiary used in the demolition of the towers. Now, they come up with a lot of great information that everybody should look at. I totally believe them because we at some point see it pouring out of the buildings. There's actually liquid molten metal pouring off of these buildings. And it looks like sparks, but it's molten metal. And there were molten piles of metal at the bottom of the rubble piles for months. So it's incredible to think that they installed this thermite or maybe brought it in through the planes. I mean, we don't want to start guessing, but the buildings were melted or the planes were being melted as we were watching them collapse. And the melting is key because a lot of the rubble is melted. Now, let's listen to Mr. Larry Silverstein. Again, the developer is speaking. This is an interview about why Building 7 fell. And this was broadcast on PBS. And this is funny because Mr. Silverstein thinks he's doing something very compassionate in describing why he had to destroy a landmark like World Trade Center 7 on a day like September 11th. So let's listen to Mr. Silverstein.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such a terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And then we watched the building collapse.
Okay. Well, pull, obviously, is a, as I've learned in my 9/11 truth investigations, that pull is a demolition term for bringing a building down. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that they say to each other in the setting up or demolishing of these buildings. Pulling number four, you know, we're going to pull it, ready to pull it. So he makes the admission that
he was ordered.
That he made a conscious decision in his mind because of what had already occurred to go ahead and let the building flame out, because we all know that when a building is on fire, it's just going to collapse into its own footprint and it's going to melt and there's going to be no core columns left standing. We all know that's going to happen when we just let a building burn for 5 hours.
Right.
So very questionable statement from Mr. Silverstein. What is he talking about? What do you think he means by pull it? I do have an answer to that. I know what he said. I know how he answered the assertion that what he was saying was destroy the building. What he says is he's recanted and he's actually said that, no, he meant the building was so far out of whack, or it was so far destroyed,
right.
So much destruction.
It was unsavable.
That they brought the fire department and all the first responders out. So we were pulling them out.
Right.
He says, no, we're going to pull the... So I ask you, what do you think? Do you think he's pulling firefighters out the way he just described that? Or do you feel that he's just being compassionate and giving a reason for why he had to destroy a building that day?
It's perplexing to me that, you know, like many of these interviews that happened early on, that people answer a certain way or say certain things, and then afterwards they, you know, make excuses for why they said it, or, you know,
they recant.
They recant, or some of the information is like, you know, no longer available. Right. Like, unless you have it in your video, you know, your videotape.
Now, the problem with it is that he feels we're all so naive that he's doing us a favor by sitting on his throne and explaining to us, the common people, why he had to do what he had to do.
Right.
He felt he was doing something polite and correct.
Right.
So that's the savagery of the type of people that we're dealing with.
Right.
That they feel that, lying or molding the situation is how they basically got to where they are in life. So,
also it behooves him. He owns the lease to all of that. So the more damage that occurs, the more he stands to inherit in an insurance claim.
And when you ask, what are the motives? You got to look for motives in any crime, right? So when you look for a motive, in Mr. Silverstein, you can find that motive in money. So let me just throw out some figures real quick. The lease, let me read this real quick. So the lease agreement applied to one So Larry Silverstein's lease agreement with the World Trade Center applied to 1, 2, 4, and 5 World Trade Center and about 425,000 square feet of retail space. This is the key. Silverstein put up $14 million of his own money to secure the deal. So the terms of the lease gave Silverstein as the complete leaseholder of the facility. So he spent $14 million of his own money. Once the towers were destroyed, once all the insurance monies were paid to Mr. Silverstein and his organization, it came out to $4.5 billion for an initial investment of $14 million. I tell you, is that investing? Is that a motive? What does that mean? So who wouldn't pay $14 million, murder 3,000 people, to get $4.5 billion? Is that a motive? Do we have him or what?
I mean, that's a motive.
That's it.
That's a motive. I mean, you know, the whole thing is complicated. Also, I mean, he's got to pay, according to his lease, $1 million a month, regardless.
That's pennies in the pot at this point.
But I'm saying it would behoove him to get the most amount of money for an insurance claim. If you know, think about it, whether or not the towers are there or not, he's, what is it, a 100-year lease he's got?
I believe it is.
It's a 100-year lease.
Yeah, 99.
And it's $1 million a month that he's got to pay, regardless. You know what I mean? So
$12 million a year is nothing.
Right.
Now,
no, it's nothing, but still, it's a lot of money. And if I had to pay $12 million a year and lose the opportunity of the revenue from all the...
But when you're saying he's paying that into...
The owners, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, whoever owned the land, which is, I believe, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, right? Yeah. So he's got to pay this regardless. So if I was him, I'd be interested in getting the most money I can, or I could, right?
Well, he absolutely did that, and now he's a billionaire,
mm-hmm.
and he was certainly complicit. He had to be the person, again, like Bernard Kerik, somebody like Silverstein in place in order for all of this to happen.
Right. Well, Kerik, by the way, I looked him up. I had read a book.
Is he in prison?
Yeah, he is in prison.
Nah, thank God.
He's in federal prison.
I hope he's enjoying it.
Well, you know, he was the head of corrections. He was a military and police. I remember from reading, he was a correction commissioner of the city of New York, okay. Which... You know, if you're in the correctional department, you're not very well liked. So you wouldn't be able to just go to any kind of regular prison within the five boroughs or within the outer boroughs. And obviously police commissioner, but he also was the interim minister of the interior of Iraq. So he was in head of security.
That was his Bush. That was his job. Right. That was his job for, now that is proof.
For the military.
That is, no, well, that's proof that he was involved in the, he was involved in the events of 9/11, because everybody who did something that helped it become, you know, helped it be completed was promoted. Mm-hmm. Nobody was fired. Mm-hmm. Nobody was let go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let's jump to number four. Jump into number four. This is a very interesting topic. This is, again, on the Pentagon, and Flight 77 that approached the Pentagon is a discrepancy in some NTSB provided flight data recorder data, and it's an animation that's provided by the NTSB on the flight data recordings from Flight 77 that allegedly hit the Pentagon. The interesting part to this is, and every plane. Now, I'm not a pilot, obviously, and I'm not an expert in this, but I get this information from a website called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. .org. Now, I definitely recommend you go to Pilots for 9/11 Truth. That is my all-time favorite. They present it in amazing ways. What they do is they beat the government with math. And if you can beat them in the details, that's what this show is all about. Let me tell you. So they got them in the details. Okay. So what they did was they requested through the Freedom of Information Act. Request. I would recommend everybody learn what a Freedom of Information Act request is. Through that request, Pilots for 9/11 Truth, Mr. Rob Balsamo, was given a flight data recording animation from the NTSB. And we watched the plane go up. You see all the movements of the sticks. You see everything that the pilots was doing when they were going up, and you see the hijacking, and you see it turn back and what have you. But when a plane ascends, the pilots have to make a correction to what's called an altimeter. An altimeter is a device on a plane that measures the altitude from the plane to the ground. So when the planes go, when the planes take off, there's something called barometric pressure that has something to do with the weather, and they make a correction to the altimeter.
Right.
And that makes that gives them the correct altitude from the plane to the ground.
Right.
So
the correct distance that they're going to need to land the plane properly. I mean, how do you know how high you are off the ground if you don't have any of these devices? And that's what this is.
Right. So what happens is, what's interesting, and this is the smoking gun, when the plane goes up, we see the altimeter snap back. So the pilot made the correct adjustment to the barometric pressure, and we had the correct altitude. So we see the altimeter snap back. And then we see the turn and the hijacking and the spin, you know, and the rotating a barrel dive into the side of the Pentagon. But what we don't see on the descent is the altimeter being reset.
Mm.
Now, that's a big problem, okay? And that could mean a few things. That could mean that they falsified this NTSB information to, you know, Rob Balsamo, that they fabricated this to illustrate the story, but they didn't think that somebody with a brain was going to look at it.
And present it as some sort of evidence.
Absolutely. Go through the math. Mm-hmm. And the altimeter was not reset on descent. So that puts the Flight 77 above.
Not on the ground.
Absolutely not. the animation claims that it was 180 feet above, I guess, sea level, mm-hmm. or above the ground, mm-hmm. going into the building. Mm-hmm. Now, the plane, without that altimeter correction, the plane's actual height was 479 feet above the ground. And that's the difference in the math, or that's the difference in this altimeter adjustment is pretty major. So all pilots know to do it, and they didn't make, so the hijackers didn't know to make that correction on the way down.
The supposed hijackers.
We don't know what their...
If that plane was hijacked.
Yeah, and we don't know what their explanation is for that not taking place.
And of course,
the plane is not where
the thing in question here is that there was actually no plane that hit the Pentagon, that it was something else.
We have to assume that something flew over the Pentagon based on their own data.
Right, but the question is, what hit the Pentagon?
In my opinion,
right.
My personal opinion, it was a plane. Obviously, it was some sort of jetliner the size of a 767 coming in, releasing some sort of air service.
So like a missile.
And again, this is just my personal opinion. And into the building. So
a missile of some sort.
We don't have a Boeing at the Pentagon, so it had to be a missile.
Right.
But based on the damage done and the damage path to the rings.
Right.
Now, let's see. So... In understanding where the errors are made in the 9/11 investigation, and people like Rob Balsamo from 9/11 Pilots for 9/11Truth.org can find that information. How many more things are we going to find before we get the attention and the new investigation begins? I need to know. That's why we're here. So let's move quickly to number 5. This is
I like number 5. I like that.
Do you like number 5?
I do because this kind of like sets the precedent, you know, in an official document that the government has been involved in taking certain orders to cause damage under the guise of setting a stage that we've been attacked to provoke some sort of war.
There it is. And it's called a false flag.
Right.
And a false flag operations, they are part of American history,
sure.
or world history.
Sure.
And
this is not the first time something has been done. Obviously, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you can go as far back as whatever. But let's look at that. Let's look at the Northwoods document.
Yes.
Well, I love that. It's my favorite.
I'm glad you like it because it's great. This is considered the blueprint of the 9/11 conspiracy, because it is definitely a conspiracy. It is Operation Northwoods, which was prepared by our Joint Chief Chairman, Mr. Lyman Lemnitzer. And again, all of this information is just the ground foundation of the 9/11 movement.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've heard of this, stick with us. It's needed to hear, it's needed to hear information. So
it's one of the documents that wasn't shredded.
Right.
Under the Kennedy investigation, the assassination of Kennedy.
This is correct. So this is how we got this information.
Right.
Was from the Kennedy records
how many
being
years,
released.
By the way, how many years was it? Which we will talk about the Kennedy assassination conspiracy amongst other things. But how many years was it from the actual time, like over 40 something years before it became public information?
I believe it's either 30 or 40.
Something yes. like that.
They seal presidential records.
Right.
Obama did it for Bush.
Right.
And yes, so that's every president does it for the previous.
Right.
President.
And I think the time has decreased from when the public can actually access those records since the 60s. No, or is it still 40 years?
I believe it's based on that president's decision.
But okay.
No,
so
I believe it's always a 30. It's always multiple. Decades.
Got it. So, anyway, this is one of the documents that survived once those documents became public. A lot of the original documents were shredded. So this was one of the few items that survived all that.
That's right. And just to let you know that John F. Kennedy did refuse this recommendation. So kudos to John F. Kennedy,
right.
who was considered our last real president.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened to Mr. Kennedy? We all know our last real president, which is a scary thought.
Yeah.
You know, because if they want to get real.
Yeah.
They take him into the room and show him the Zapruder.
Anyway, film. you guys gotta, you know, Google Operation Northwoods,
for sure.
Wikipedia it. You know what I mean?
So what it is, it was a justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba. So this was happening back in the 60s when we were, you know, at odds with Cuba.
The height of the Cold War.
They were backed by the Russians and the missiles and what happened. So what our government did was create a recommendation to John F. Kennedy that we attack ourselves or stage a false flag event that will garner congressional support and public support for them to go to war with Cuba. So I just want to read you a few excerpts from Operation Northwoods, and you tell me what you think, Nestor. So, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm picking pieces and parts, but it says, it is assumed, this is very interesting to me, this point. It is assumed that there will be similar submissions from other agencies.
Mm.
So, like you said, the documents that were shredded were all these other submissions from other agencies, not people, but agencies.
Government agencies.
Hundreds of people, thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just one person being this savage.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I go on to read, this plan incorporating projects selected from the ATAT suggestions or from other sources should be developed to focus all efforts on specific ultimate objectives, which would provide adequate justification for U.S. military intervention.
Right.
So exactly what you said.
Action against Cuba.
That is exactly right.
It's many, many, many years have passed, but, you know, we were trying to attack Cuba. We want to kill Fidel Castro, right? But to kill Fidel Castro would have meant to pretty much start a war. So how are you going to do this?
That would have been a nuclear war.
A nuclear war. How are you going to do this? How are you going to start a war with Cuba that's backed by Russia, you know, and make it seem like it's justified? How are you going to do that?
Right. You're not. You're not.
Can't. You so, can't do it.
No, they would have been very bad. So that's why John F. Kennedy had the mind to stop it.
Right. But are you reading some of the suggestions that are...
Yes. So another part is very interesting. They will commence large-scale United States military operations with quote-unquote, remember the main incidents... that could be arranged to coincide with the event.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I asked you, this is in black and white, remember the main. What do they ask us to do about 9/11? Do they ask us to investigate it? Do they ask us to look into it, ask questions about it? No. The only thing they tell us to do about 9/11 is to remember it and to never forget.
Right.
So here it is. It's already in their documentation that they create these fictitious events.
Don't question.
No questions, just remember.
Right.
So we can continue. Remember how bad it was so we can continue running our crazy.
Which fortunately unfortunately for them, America has like the shortest attention span. So we don't remember shit. So that doesn't work.
So let me just keep reading. I just have a little more and then we'll get to the juicy part.
Yeah.
We could blow up a drone, an unmanned vessel anywhere in the Cuban waters. We could arrange to cause such incident in the vicinity of Havana or Santiago as a spectacular result of a Cuban attack from the air or sea or both. So that's giving you that's telling you basically that, hey, we will destroy their country for our purposes in a deceitful way.
Right.
So let me get to the place where...
So in order to accomplish the start of a war, the plan was to create certain events, certain things, create these events that supposedly would have been seen as... instigations by Cuba. Correct. Against us.
That's
so
right.
That we would retaliate.
Hostile actions.
Right. And then we would be like, well, we didn't do anything wrong.
Right. And good luck with that.
Right.
So one of the things that they mentioned they would do is develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in Miami and other Florida cities and even in Washington. So
right.
We're not just talking about attacking Cuba.
Right.
Here we go. Here it is. This is American soil right. there. We're going to blow something up on American soil and blame Cuba.
Right.
But then it goes on to say, and this is one of the most interesting parts, the terror campaign could be pointed at Cuban refugees seeking haven in the U.S. We could sink a boatload of Cubans en route to Florida, real or simulated.
Right. Right.
Can you imagine? So real or simulated? I mean, we might do it.
There's a whole
list.
We
could do it with real guys, fake guys.
Nah. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
There's a slew of ideas that you could do. Start rumors about Cuba by using clandestine radios.
Right.
Staging mock attacks, sabotages, and riots at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base and blaming it on Cuban forces. So basically you're saying, start some shit.
Yep.
Harming, putting your own men, U.S. Armed servicemen in danger.
That's
and
right.
Blaming it on Cuban forces, right?
Horrible.
Firebombing and sinking an American ship at the Guantanamo Bay American military base.
Yep.
People question, the biggest thing is, well, why would the government put Americans at danger? Why would you kill your own people? If you look at it, seriously, if you look at the whole thing, how many people actually died in the World Trade Center events? I know you have a number, right?
Yeah, the total number of deaths in September 11th is 2,996.
Okay, how many died in Vietnam?
That I think that was in the 50s of, don't quote me, but I think that's in the 50s of thousands, 65,000.
Okay, and now the thing is, these are pawns. You have to...
They are pawns.
You're just a pawn. Unfortunately and tragically, these innocent people were just doing their... American duty of showing up for work.
Right. So let me get to the blueprint of 9/11. So that is, we're still in Northwoods. Let me just read this before we do run out of time. This is very important. This is the actual blueprint of 9/11. So let me read it. It kind of goes on and on. So it says, an aircraft at Elgin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. Shady, right? So it says, as at a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with selected passengers. This is key because people say, well, what happened to the passengers? Listen to their plan. So it said, at a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with the selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone. The takeoff time of the drone and aircraft and the actual aircraft would be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. So they're actually going to meet in the air, swap out, right? So from the rendezvous point, the passenger carrying aircraft will, descend to a minimum altitude and go directly into an auxiliary field at Elgin Air Force Base. So what do you think about that? So you have... unmanned, you have specifically registered people on a flight that have had their identities created for the flight. The flight goes up. The flight is swapped for a drone, and then they explode the drone. What does that sound? Is that 9/11 or
well,
is
what
that
sounds like is this. This is in 1962 or 3?
Operation Northwoods?
Yeah.
Operation
62.
Yeah, Operation
Northwoods. What this sounds like is that in 1962, if they had the capability of doing this, the technology of doing it, what else? I mean, we're talking about 2001, people.
Right.
Okay.
That's key. Yeah, they had the ability to make the drones,
ability. They've probably, fine-tuned the formulas and the deceptions that they could have carried out.
They could have.
This is 1962. This is documented. These are ideas that were written down and proposed.
Yes. to the highest.
So the president.
Highest level of military order in the world. And it is truly unbelievable.
The subject is justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba. That's the...
Says it all.
Right.
When you look at something like Northwoods, or when you look at all this information that we've prepared for you today, you have to stop. You have to think about what has, how have our lives changed as a result of 9/11? And I ask you in closing, I know we only have a few minutes left, but Nestor, what are your feelings about how life was transformed?
We have a few minutes. We have enough time to kick it a little bit. Okay. How has life been transformed? Well,
what was the most important ripple effect?
The first thing I started noticing straight up the back, I travel a lot. So I see a lot of airports and I have to go through a lot of airport security. The first thing I noticed was the manipulation of fear. Okay, right after the events,
right.
What is it? Threat level orange. That went on for fucking ever for like 2 or 3 years, creating this fear that you're not safe.
And who even paid attention to the color? Well, did you ever log on to find out what color it was today?
No. But I mean, it's just, I mean, you're going through airport security and you're saying, what the fuck is, fear threat level orange? It's like, when is that shit going to fucking change? Homeland Security is implemented. Civil rights, the main thing you start noticing is that your civil rights are in jeopardy. Right? At any time, anyone can come and start questioning you, searching you, and intruding on your own privacy under the guise of, you're a terrorist. I mean, it's almost going back to the McCarthy era.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. To me, the most important ripple effect is the inability for any of us to now be individual. So when I say that, I mean, we can no longer walk down the street by ourselves. Mm. We are being monitored.
Mm.
Look up on the phone poles. I mean, if people would look up from the smartphones and look at the top of those poles, those weren't there prior to 9/11.
Right.
And it is we are constantly monitored, constantly asked to snitch on our neighbors.
I mean,
snitching programs.
That's just some of the obvious stuff. And
the most domineering to me.
9/11 surcharges, extra taxes.
Now that's at the airport, correct?
At the airport, on your cell phone bill.
Really? On your cell phone
bill? Yeah, all sorts of shit that, which is fine, as a tax-paying citizen of the United States, I think that we all have to pay our share. But what is this shit going for? These are things that are created. Look, at the end of the day, as a result of 9/11, unfortunately, money was to be made by a lot of people. You can't bring bottles of water through flight. Who benefits from this?
Well, let me ask you, before we go, one more question for you, Nestor. I got to know. I'm curious. What, in your opinion, what was their end game? What was it all for? What was the point? 3,000 Americans dead, multiple wars, billions of dollars.
I think
thousands of casualties in our military.
To open up Starbucks and McDonald's in Afghanistan.
Could that possibly be what it was
ultimately
about?
Ultimately.
Or could it have been about growing poppies in Afghanistan, getting the Taliban out? All of these things we hear, a lithium vein in Afghanistan, and now we need to go in and get the lithium.
It was,
all of this craziness, what was the end game?
In my opinion, it was to back up the war in Afghanistan.
To go get them.
To take over. And how we can take over is oil, right? Oil is king, right?
That's it.
So at the end of the day, has that been accomplished?
I don't believe it's been accomplished because our oil is higher than ever and our gas prices are higher than ever.
So then that was all for naught.
So far, it is for naught. And that is what we're here for on The Devil's in the Details.
Anyway,
we need to find out this
up.
Information. Let's wrap it up. So I want to make a special thank you to Mr. Jeremy Hansen for giving us the opportunity to do our show today.
SkidRowStudios.com.
Yeah, we appreciate the time. And I'd also like to thank our executive producer, Mr. Sal Rodriguez, because without Sal, we certainly wouldn't be here. Listen to Registered Ear Offenders. Every Friday from 1 to 2, and we will be following that coming on
right after
Registered Ear Offender.
Exactly.
So thank you, Nestor.
Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/Nestorius, and we'll be more information about our show.
Yep. Thank you for joining us on our first show, Nestor, and I'll see you next week, man.
Likewise, yeah. Kick it.
Didn't wanna be a rock star. Play my music in the real fine bar.